Inmates across Florida and the nation are on strike inside prisons, demanding an end to torture and abuse. We'll tell you about it. Hope you had a nice weekend. Good Tuesday morning out there. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, a look at the national movement for prison reform and why Florida is ground zero for that. Get on the line now with your thoughts and questions. 549-2937. Then later, it's one of the leading causes of stroke in this country. We'll tell you why cases of AFib, as it's called, are on the rise and what you need to know about that. Plus, we've got to look ahead to this month's Sing Out Loud Festival in St. Augustine. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, a look inside the national prison strike. You may have heard about this. Now, it started last month as inmates here in Florida and across the country joined in to this strike within their facilities, resisting what they say is cruel and inhumane treatment. Inmates are also demanding to be paid state wages for their labor inside prisons, and they're calling for an end to what they say is widespread torture and abuse. Florida prisons in particular have been notorious for years for these allegations. According to the Miami Herald, at least 145 people have died in state penal facilities this year so far, making Florida's prisons among the deadliest in the country. Many of the striking inmates in Florida have, in fact, been punished with solitary confinement over the last month. The national prison strike ends this Sunday, September 9th. On that night, a program about the issue of mass incarceration in America and the movement for prison reform is taking place at the Corazon Cinema and Cafe in St. Augustine. St. Augustine artist Wendy Tatter is one of the organizers, and she joins us now with more about mass incarceration in America and the push for prison reform. Wendy, good to see you.
Hi, thank you, Melissa. I'm happy to be here.
And we do have a carceral state in this country. We incarcerate more people than perhaps any other developed country in the world, the majority of them people of color. Activists for years have called it the new Jim Crow. In fact, there's even a book called that. What are your questions and thoughts about this? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. We're already getting your comments as well on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And so, Wendy, your son Emmett did nearly 10 years in prison, so you have a personal connection to this. We'll talk about that in a moment and the event as well. But first, let's get into what's been happening over the last several weeks, this national prison strike. Inmates across the country refusing to do labor inside prisons, issuing a list of grievances and demands, saying that they're being tortured and abused. Mm-hmm. We've heard about this for years. Now, inmates around the nation are erupting. Let's talk about what we know about this strike.
Well, it's very interesting to me because I've seen the abuse and the low wages. They work for 22 cents an hour. And their families aren't able to subsist on that kind of thing. And there's no way that they can send money home. But if they were given a decent wage, they could keep their family alive and moving forward while they're serving their time. Also, the abuse is rampant. I've witnessed it.
What have you witnessed?
I've seen people, well, I haven't actually seen it myself. I've stood in line with family members who told me of the cases of abuse, especially at Suwanee, which is a prison up north of us. And they are sprayed with pepper spray through the little vents in their cells. They are put in solitary confinement in freezing conditions with the air conditioner turned totally down in just underwear. They are handcuffed behind them. They're walked out, and then they yell, "We're saving a life," and they slam them into a wall. I mean, these things happen, and I'm not saying that every correctional officer does these things. There are great ones who I've met over the 10-year period of my son being incarcerated, but there are definitely these things happening.
One particularly notorious case in Florida was the case of Darren Rainey. He was an incarcerated man with a history of schizophrenia. He was scalded to death when prison officers forced him into a shower of boiling hot water. Now, you're going to be doing this event Sunday with another formerly incarcerated man named Molière Demanche. He's also an author and an artist, and his prison art has actually become quite celebrated. Yeah. He has alleged brutal forms of punishment that he's depicted through his artwork. Now, you talked about the solitary incarceration. Mm-hmm. Demanche alleges what they do in some facilities is what they call the strip. Mm-hmm. Guards punish inmates for infractions by taking their linen, mattress, clothing, and then they put them in a solitary for 72 hours in a freezing cold cell with nothing but their underwear.
Exactly.
And just sort of in a box with nothing to sit on.
And you're shivering the entire time, and then they let you out, and then they put you back in again.
Slamming prisoners' heads against walls, gassing people through their cells, as you said. The ACLU documents that African Americans are subjected to more abuse. There are some actual Klan members who are Florida prison guards. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about mass incarceration in America and what activists and academics call the new Jim Crow, this particularly affects men of color more than any other group.
Men of color, Latinos, and sadly, the mentally ill are adversely affected. They tend to spend 7 years longer than any other group in prison because they're so misunderstood by the officers aren't trained to take care of a mentally ill person. So they give them infractions and put them in solitary. And it's just a constant, a revolving door.
And the prison strike is a demand for wages, better conditions, mm-hmm. A few other things. What would you say to those listening who might argue, well, if they committed a crime, I don't care how bad the conditions are in prison?
I would say that our country has got to take a look at what's happening. The longer sentences, the poor conditions do not make a better person come out of prison. The way to make a better person come out of prison and enter into society is to move forward, teach them a trade, treat them humanely. It's been proven that if you treat someone humanely, they become a better person. There's countless tests that have been done over this. And that's what we need to start looking at in the United States.
The push for prison reform also calls for an end to mandatory minimums. And in Florida, reinstating felons' rights.
Right.
So how does that translate to what we see here in Florida, where we have a number of prisons, most of them private prisons? Mm-hmm. And so Florida is really the epicenter of this controversy.
I think what a lot of people don't understand about mandatory minimums, yes, it's a 10-year sentence for your first offense, 20, and then 25 to life for the third. But what people don't understand about mandatory minimums is that the judge has no discretion to change the sentencing once the case goes to court. So even if the judge says, oh, there were mitigating circumstances, he was attacked from behind and he killed someone, he cannot change that sentence. The sentence stands the way it is, so a judge has no power. Hence, there is no use having a judge in there when you know what's going to happen. The outcome of the sentencing is mandatory minimum.
Okay, and let's talk briefly about Sunday's event. You will be speaking along with the former inmate, now an attorney and artist, Molière Demanche. Uh-huh. What's going to be happening?
We are showing a short film about mandatory minimums and what it means to people who aren't involved in the prison system and why you should be involved. We're going to have a speaker from Texas named Julia Lazarek, who is going to speak about how prison sentences affect the families of those who are incarcerated. My son Emmett will be speaking about his experiences in prison and the way that reentry programs can help or don't help. And Molière Demanche will be speaking about the abuse in prison and how his artwork got him through. He will also be having an exhibit of his artwork. And at the end of the event, we'll have a panel discussion with question and answers for them.
It's 549-2937. As we talk about mass incarceration in America, what are your comments and thoughts? Let's go to Regina in Orange Park now. Hi, Regina. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, ma'am. How are you?
Oh, it's not Regina. It's that's your last name.
Reginald.
Oh, Reginald. Okay.
Yes.
All right. All right, go ahead.
Yes, I would like to make a statement, and I'll take your opinion of my statement off air. My thing is this, ma'am. We have to understand that the prison system is America, starting with Louisiana, Angola, is nothing more than slave labor. The reason being, they were taking people, majority of the people they took were black people, and put them right back in bondage. And Angola started out as a slave labor camp. They disguised it as, oh, we're going to teach you a trade. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And it was nothing more than slavery. Okay? And if they had no care or no concern on how they treated slaves, it hasn't changed. Because they treat people the same exact way. And as the young lady stated earlier, if you treat someone humanely, then they are more inclined to act humanely. But what I'm getting at is this. Until we revamp the way America thinks with this them and us concept, nothing will never change. We can talk about all these issues all day long, but until we actually take action to change the hearts and minds of the people, everything will remain the same. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Reginald. And the whole point of this prison strike is demanding an end to what inmates call slave labor. Prisoners across the country have joined work stoppages, hunger strikes, commissary boycotts in at least 11 states, including Florida. Many have been punished with solitary confinement. What kinds of labor are people doing in Florida prisons?
Can I say something here?
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is really important is to know that when you're in a work release program here in Florida, you have to give 55% of the money that you are making in a real job back to the prison. And a really important point that has, it's not labor involved, but people in prison have to pay, the families have to pay for their phone calls and they have to pay for their canteen. And the money is not taxed, but they add on at least $7.95 per time that you send your inmates some money. And then the phone calls cost an average of 14 cents a minute, which is really a lot when you're a starving family and you have no income and your person is in prison. So the fact that you have to pay so much of your hard-earned cash, and then you have to pay off your court costs and you have to pay all your probation costs, that adds up and people can't afford it, and then they end up back in prison.
It's 549-2937 to join us now. This prison strike began on August 21st and it ends on September 9th. Interestingly, these are dates that reflect, I didn't realize this, I'm just learning this, the legacy of rebellion in American prisons. Mm-hmm. On August 21st, 1971, a man named George Jackson was killed by prison guards in San Quentin. That death was met by protests in prisons around the country. It culminated in the famed September 9th uprising at the Attica facility in upstate New York. Older listeners might remember this. And they're trying to emphasize the fact that very little has changed in terms of conditions in American prisons. And then just going beyond the strike itself, The push to end the mass incarceral state in America is one that's been going on for years. We incarcerate more people than any other nation. And let's talk about the reasons behind that, because I'm getting tweets from and emails from listeners asking why do we have such a high percentage of incarcerated people as compared to other developed nations?
Actually, I think it's all money oriented. I think our government and our states make a lot of money when they incarcerate someone, and it's just a revolving door. Once you're in the system, you have a felony conviction. You can't get a good job once you get out. You go back to a life of crime, and most inmates, 38% will go back to prison within 3 years of being incarcerated.
And Florida has a higher number of private facilities, which are for-profit. The knock on privatization of prisons is that if there's a profit motive, then there's a demand for more product,
prisoners.
Which is more prisoners. And exactly. So on the other hand, proponents of privatization say it's just more efficient economically. So, but Florida is really the ground zero of this debate because we have such a high high percentage, I should say, of private prisons, most of them here in North Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all the most of the reentry centers are private as well.
It's 549-2937 as we talk about the national prison strike in America and in Florida. Anna is on the north side. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Well, I'm calling for to make two comments. One on the what the young lady just said about the cost, and she's absolutely correct. Families are often the unintended victims of the crime that their loved ones committed, and we don't try to, you know, go against that. If they committed a crime, then that's one thing. But the families often end up having to pay, like she said, through the canteens, through just sending them money so they can be able to purchase personal items, the phone calls, and now they're starting a new thing where you can do video calls and video chats. And all of that is going to cost if the family wants to be able to talk with their loved ones and then see them face to face.
Exactly.
And the other thing is that we do need to look at these mandatory minimums. If a person commits a crime with a gun, then they should be sentenced for that crime at that time, not just slap a mandatory minimum on them and just let them go away for the rest of their lives. People make mistakes, sometimes really bad mistakes, but if possible, they should have a chance at a second chance at living their life.
Thanks for that, Anna. Yeah. Thank you for that. Billy is in Jacksonville. Hi, Billy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wanted to call and comment that I think the system that we have is just really, really broken. It needs to be corrected. I think it's ridiculous. You know, having been in prison myself, I know what it's like, and I don't know. And the numbers y'all were just quoting about how many people go back, I don't think that's correct. I know federal prison, it's an 87% recidivism rate, which means 87% of people who go to prison go right back. So it's a terrible thing. And then on top of that, the private prisons are for profit, so they're adding, like you say, all these unnecessary fees that families and the prisoners have to pay, which is ridiculous. It's hard on everybody. And it's unnecessary. Anyway, I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Billy. Thanks for that.
It's kind of a money-making machine is what we have going on here.
And the strike going on where inmates are refusing to work. Mm-hmm. I mean, the stereotype of prison labor is what? Making license plates?
Or being in the cafeteria.
Or working in the cafeteria. But Inmates do a lot of jobs.
Oh, yeah.
What kind of jobs do they do?
Not in Florida necessarily, but they do build furniture. They make, a lot of times, they make the clothing that the officers wear, which is kind of self-perpetuating, and the shoes. And in the work release program, which is kind of nice, they can go on. My son went on a job where he worked for an electric company and he learned a lot there. Not that he's going to use it after he gets out, but there are programs that during your time in a reentry prison like Baker, which is where he was, they do have a few classes you can take in culinary, in electric, and wiring and all that kind of thing. And they do help you get transition if you choose to use it. But once again, once you get out, you have a felony conviction. Unless we can vote and get rid of the stigma of being a felon the rest of your life, you can't use any of these things because you can't get a license to do it.
And, you know, the whole movement to ban the box, the box that people with a felony conviction have to check on an employment application.
Exactly.
Some of the proponents of that national movement actually it originated in Jacksonville.
Exactly.
And so that's another issue that we have a local tie. Mm-hmm. The whole idea that if you have a felony conviction, if you have to disclose that on a job interview, you're not going to get
that job. You're not going to get the job. Why would they hire that person?
Let's go now to Rusty in Jacksonville. Hi, Rusty. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I have mixed feelings about the topic this morning. First, I think when we talk about a topic like this, about how they're treated once in prison, whether they make an appropriate amount of money, and the financial burden on the family, we first have to look at, are they there justly? And when I say that, I mean, were they rightly convicted? Are they actually guilty of the crime they're charged of? And if they are, none of that really matters. What matters is that we have people in prison wanting minimum wage, I guess, is what we're talking about. We're already paying to house them. Now we're going to pay them and house them. And everything that they get in prison as far as access to phones and computer, voicemails, whatever, someone else is paying for all of that. And that's us, the taxpayers.
We are.
Okay. And thanks, Rusty, for that. And I'm getting tweets about this as well, saying it costs more to keep criminals in prison than most law-abiding citizens earn, and they want a living wage, really? So people pushing back on the demand for prisoners to be paid more for their labor. What about that?
I don't think they're asking to be paid the minimum wage. I think they're asking to be paid more than 22 cents an hour, and they're asking to have it be sent to their families so their families can be sustained while they're in prison. Also, they're asking to be able to manufacture things, do artwork, and have that be accessible to people to buy so that they can maintain their families. And I'm not suggesting that people should not be punished for their crimes. I am certainly not suggesting that. My son did a terrible crime. He spent his 8 years in there. He did good things while he was in there, but many people don't have the opportunities or the help or the mentors that he and a few other people have. Now, people need some kind of hope in there to not go back to their crime. And these long sentences are only making us taxpayers pay more money to keep people in longer than they really need to be in and keep them from having rehabilitating programs that we should be doing instead of keep having long prison sentences.
All right. Yolanda is on the line in historic Springfield. Yolanda, good morning.
Good morning. This is a really great show. First thing I want to say is that I am a retired corrections officer, 25 years in the sixth, probably at the time, largest jail in the United States.
Oh, what was that? Which one was that?
In Miami-Dade County.
Okay.
Yeah, and so although there is a difference between jails and prisons, corrections is an industry. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the callers that have, and the speaker this morning, everyone is pretty much correct, but a part of the conversation that's missing is folks' voices like such as mine, who actually support criminal justice reform, bond reform, mm-hmm. and recidivism. You know, there's the history behind corrections that dates back, like your first caller said, all the way back to the turn of the century or post-emancipation and during Reconstruction. So all that plays on a factor to include the current issues of having Klansmen who are corrections officers mm-hmm. in some of our prison systems. And so with that said, I think that I support their strike because something has to change because it is a multi-billion-dollar industry. And the taxpayers, we're paying the cost of it, mm-hmm. you know. My reasons for supporting them is not necessarily for minimum wage. I definitely support a nonviolent, and I'm not sure what all the issues are, but I'm sure there's a handful of issues that I can support being on the, quote-unquote, the us against them on the other side historically. But I think that something has to change because what we're doing and what I have been saying as an ambassador for the ACLU is not working.
Right. Thanks, Yolanda. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. It's interesting to hear from someone who worked in the system.
I would love to have you come on Sunday and speak a little bit at my event.
Yeah, this is the time now where we invite everyone who is interested in this topic to come to Sunday night's event at the Corazon Cinema and Cafe in St. Augustine. It's a program about mass incarceration and prison reform, along with a film screening. Mm-hmm. What time is this all kicking
off? It starts at 5, and it probably go till about 9, I figure. Yeah. The film's very short. It's a very small part of the program, but it's pretty potent.
So come on out Sunday night, 5 p.m., to the Corazon Cinema and Cafe in St. Augustine. It will coincide with the end of It's a several weeks long national prison strike, which will end on Sunday the 9th. Wendy Tatter, activist and artist, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And much more still ahead on the show. Later, we've got to look ahead to this month's Sing Out Loud Festival. A whole month of free concerts in St. Augustine. But up next, it's one of the most common causes of stroke, but you might not know much about AFib and your risk. That's next.
I'm Stephen Dubner, host of Freakonomics Radio. Every week, Freakonomics Radio explores the hidden side of everything, from what our Google searches reveal about us, to whether the American dream is still alive, to whether rich people are really more selfish than poor people. I hope you'll join me Sunday at 1 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
What if you could be you without all of the responsibility, all of the guilt, the pain, and none of the self-loathing? Well, on the Next Step Judgment, maybe you can. We proudly present The Proxy. Snap Judgment. Storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Discover new music at the Electro Lounge Monday through Saturday nights at 9, only on 89.9 FM. We've got your chill. Tune in and enjoy fresh music from around the world.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical for your safety in a weather emergency. Visit a public library to get your 2018 Hurricane Preparedness Guide. Stay informed with real-time updates at jacksready.com or download the Jax Ready app to also identify your specific zone and important information. Keep your radio on 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Welcome back. Well, a recent study published in the Journal of the American Heart Association reveals that emergency rooms around the country are seeing a big uptick in admittance for atrial fibrillation, or AFib. It's the most common heart arrhythmia and a leading cause of stroke in America. Annual ER visits for AFib are up 30%, leading doctors to label this issue a major public health challenge. Now, Normally, the study also found that hospitalization rates for AFib in the U.S. are nearly twice as high as those in Canada and Europe. September is Atrial Fibrillation Awareness Month, so we're going to make you a little more aware about AFib as we welcome Dr. Anthony Magnano. He's a cardiac electrophysiologist with St. Vincent's Riverside. Try saying that five times fast. Dr. Magnano, good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And thanks for being with us. You know, I see these commercials on TV all the time for AFib. It's funny that we're doing this today because they seem to be everywhere lately. Let's explain first what AFib is, I guess, and then why we're seeing such a big uptick in it. What are you seeing out there?
Right. Well, atrial fibrillation is the most common sustained heart arrhythmia, and it's a leading cause of stroke in our country. So about 6.1 million people are estimated to have atrial fibrillation, but I would even bet that that number is higher if we looked really, really hard, if we were monitoring people all the time for rare episodes. And it's a rapid rhythm. The top of the heart starts firing from a place other than the sinus node, which is where we normally get our heartbeat. And it makes the top chambers quiver. And when the top chambers are quivering, blood can clot and form, that clot can go to the brain, which can lead to a stroke, but also it can make the heart beat rapidly and irregularly, which can give people symptoms and make them feel badly. So we're really seeing a great increase in the amount of atrial fibrillation recently, and you're seeing more commercials, partly because there's more atrial fibrillation, but also partly because there's more treatments for atrial fibrillation, more things we can do about it.
Okay. And why in America do you think we're so plagued with this? Why are so many Americans coming into the ER with these symptoms? And we'll talk about those in a moment.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. First of all, our population's aging, no doubt. We're living longer, and age is a big determinant of who has atrial fibrillation. Another big determinant of who gets atrial fibrillation is related to obesity levels. And if you took a plot of counties or communities in the United States and looked at their obesity rate, you could superimpose pretty much their atrial fibrillation rate, because obesity leads to a lot of other conditions that promote atrial fibrillation. So diabetes, sleep apnea, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and so forth. And then the third thing is that more people, because of success of other therapies like stents, bypass surgery, valve replacements, and so forth, more people are living with other heart diseases that predispose to atrial fibrillation. So coronary artery disease, heart failure, valvular heart disease. So I think a mix of all these things together is really kind of making an epidemic.
Wow. Okay, so what symptoms should people be watchful for? And if they come to you with problems, what are the new options for treatment?
Sure. So the symptoms you want to watch for can be very nonspecific. So some people do feel a very distinct rapid or irregular heartbeat, and they get palpitations related to it. And an irregular feeling of palpitations that are often rapid would probably be the most specific symptom. But some people don't necessarily feel that or notice it, and they might just have sort of a subtle fatigue or weakness or shortness of breath. Maybe they get chest discomfort if the heart rate goes really fast. They might feel slightly dizzy. And the puzzling thing is that especially in older individuals or sicker individuals, sometimes they don't really notice it at all. And they don't really have symptoms. And we treat a lot of patients who come in or are in atrial fibrillation, but really can't tell us that they're having anything different when they're in atrial fibrillation versus when they're not.
Okay, so the good news is, I guess, is that you can help patients more easily now than before. Isn't that right?
It's definitely true. So we've had a lot of emerging therapies. So some of the new commercials that you alluded to are because we need to protect against stroke and atrial fibrillation. That's the most important or devastating thing that could happen. And they're often really big strokes that can be life-changing, because you can form a quite large clot in the heart, and that's big in comparison to the tiny little arteries in the brain. So we need to protect people against stroke, and that was always warfarin, and that's about all we had since about early 1950s. And then we did a number of studies on new oral anticoagulants, which have become really, really common now. And there's four of them that are on the market now, which don't require as much monitoring and prevent stroke much easier, pretty much with the simplicity and safety of taking, say, an aspirin. But they work differently from aspirin, which makes them effective in preventing stroke and atrial fibrillation. So one thing that we can do is protect people against stroke and thin the blood out a little bit so they don't form a clot. We also have other ways to protect against stroke, like we're doing things called the Watchman implant. We're also doing some lariat procedures or AtriClip procedures, and those are ways to mechanically prevent strokes. So there's a pouch in the heart called the left atrial appendage. That's where the blood clots form. We have to thin your blood head to toe because we need to thin the blood in the left atrial appendage. But now we've discovered that if we just occlude or remove the atrial appendage with a simple procedure, some of them are 30 or 40 minutes long.
Oh, that's good. That's good. And let me just jump in because we're getting calls for you, doctor. Let's take a quick call for you. It's Tommy in St. Augustine. Hi, Tommy. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. How are you, Melissa?
Great. Go ahead.
Just wanted the speaker to address the role of heredity as far as, if you have heart disease in your family, which is my personal case. My dad had heart disease, and I ended up having AFib. Otherwise, being healthy, none of the other predictors of obesity or high cholesterol or high blood pressure, but I got AFib.
Yep, absolutely. So that is an issue for many Americans. How can they work around that, doctor, quickly?
Sure. So there is some role of heredity in our genes. And basically, if your parent had atrial fibrillation, you're about 50% higher risk. If both parents had it, you might be, you know, maybe three times higher risk than you would be otherwise. So there's some role of heredity. I do have a few families, and it's the minority of cases, where you see a bunch of people show up with atrial fibrillation at a much earlier age than you'd expect, like people in their 30s and 40s who come in with AFib one after the other. So there, I think there's a strong gene. In other cases, I think our genes are just sort of pushing our probabilities a little bit.
Well, we so appreciate you sharing this. Lots of interest in this. We couldn't even get all the calls on the air because September is Atrial Fibrillation Awareness Month. Know your history, know the signs and symptoms, and seek treatment if you need it. Dr. Anthony Magnano, cardiac electrophysiologist at St. Vincent's Riverside, with us to share the information which so many listeners need. Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, here's a statistic that is not the best look for the art world. Only 2% of the art in our local and national art museums in this country is by women artists. To try to change that, at least locally, there is a new exhibit opening this Friday. It's called Rise, a feminine approach to the craft of art. It's also a fundraiser, and it features nearly 24 amazing local women artists. Here with more, we welcome Jennifer Wolf, founder of Women Writing for a Change, artist and attorney Deborah Reed, and photographer Mary Atwood. Hey, ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so I didn't realize, I mean, I always figured when you go to an art museum, it's mostly male art, but I didn't realize it was that bad. 2% of art you see in museums is by women. 2%?
It may be a little bit more now, maybe 3 to 4%, but it's rather stunning. And as Deborah will tell you, because she's got all the stats, 80% of the women that are represented in the museums, of course, are naked women.
Right. That's considered art. It is art, but it speaks to just gender inequality. It's everywhere. I guess it's also in art museums too, Deborah. So how is this exhibit going to try to change that?
Well, the premise of the, or the reason for the exhibit is to call attention to it. Jennifer first learned about this about a year or so ago and immediately stepped into action by offering her home where Women Writing for a Change circles are held as an exhibition space for women. It's calling attention and taking action.
Now, Mary Atwood, you're a local photographer. Your work, which is great, is part of what will be exhibited along with a well-known local artist named Lana Shuttleworth. She does amazing artwork. She makes art out of recycled materials and many other local talents. This is exciting.
Yes, it's very exciting. I was honored to be asked to participate in this show, especially when I got an opportunity to see the other artists who are going to be there.
And do you find it's harder to get your work exhibited as a woman or not? What has your experience been like?
I do find that to be true, especially locally. I will say that I have had some successes dealing with gallery owners who were female, but I've also, when you have a larger project like the First Coast Reflections project, then it tends to be easier. But just to have smaller pieces, smaller collections of work exhibited, it's a much tougher thing for a woman. As a matter of fact, I don't even sign my work as Mary Atwood. I sign it as M. Atwood for that reason.
I mean, there's a reason J.K. Rowling wrote the Harry Potter series as J.K. Rowling, not Joe Rowling. And I remember as a kid, The Outsiders was written by S.E. Hinton. And all the little boys that read that book didn't know that S.E. Hinton was also a woman. And that's the sad reality of this. You know, when female performers go to audition at orchestras, the whole reason they do a blind audition is so that the people making the decision aren't influenced by the gender or the race of the person doing the performance, because they found that if they don't do it blind, women and minorities are less likely to get picked. So this is a way, I guess, to really make a statement about this. And it's also a fundraiser for Women Writing for a Change. Tell us about that.
Sure, because this issue exists in writing as well. Women writers are not well represented. And we were just testing this out by looking at the local paper, and all of the bylines on the front page were men. The editorial board was men. All the photos were of men. Mm-hmm. So
they used to have a really good editorial writer named Tanya Weathersby, by the way, but she left town.
Right.
Just one little bit of context to that. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
So, well, Women Writing for a Change is a 25-year-old organization led by women that was started in Cincinnati. And I'm a local affiliate of that national group. And our vision and our mission is to tell women's stories and provide a safe place for women to tell their stories. And so we do that through writing, and we do that through community building. And it was a wonderful intersection to say, okay, let's bring in women artists so that we can sit around writing inspired by the work of women artists. And so when I hold my writing circles within my home, we're surrounded by women's art. So it's really about having integrity with our process and with the idea of intentionally changing culture, because this is invisible. This is normalized. You and I never knew this until just very recently, how underrepresented women are.
Yeah.
So we've got to intentionally change that by creating new platforms.
So you've conducted hundreds of writing circles for women and men too. How does a writing circle work? What all goes on?
Well, the first idea is to create an egalitarian space where everybody sits in a circle and everyone has a chance to share. Because many of us have been burned by sort of that academic environment where we have the expert in the front of the room who towers over everyone, and then we have only a few people in the room that have the guts to actually share their work. So we create a more egalitarian, equalized circle. Everybody gets a chance to share. Everybody gets a chance to write. And then we listen to each other's words. And our focus is not only on product. Product is important, but also the process of creating a safe place for people to express themselves.
Okay, with all of that said, this looks like it's going to be quite the event. How can people be part of this big bash?
They can attend.
Show up, Jacksonville.
It will be at 1610 Osceola Street. Jennifer Wolf has graciously opened up her beautiful historic home. The work is displayed beautifully. It will be from 5:30 to 8:30. And the address is 1610 Osceola Street. There's information at the Women Writing for a Change website.
Womenwritingjacksonville.com?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay.
And to really, really participate and support women in the arts, they can purchase some of the wonderful artwork. We intentionally asked artists to include some smaller pieces so that there are things that will be within people's price range to take home with them. We have some fabulous work by Lana Shuttleworth that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. She has one piece that is of leaves floating on a pond, and everybody gravitates right towards it. Jenny Hager, a professor at UNF, has done some fabulous Women's March sculptures that are available to take home for only $150.
That's a bargain.
It is a bargain.
And many more. So again, go to womenwritingjacksonville.com for more about Women Writing for a Change and this Friday's exhibit and fundraiser, It's Rise. Some amazing female artists in this community. And this is your chance to see and purchase and learn more about their work. Ladies, Jennifer Wolf, Deborah Reed, Mary Atwood, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
And in a moment, another form of art, music. We're going to tell you about this month's Sing Out Loud Festival after this.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Khalid Abrohi, who grew up in a tribal region of Pakistan. Her mother was forced into marriage at the age of 9. Khalid's cousin was the victim of an honor killing. Khalida was the first girl in her village to go to school. Her new memoir, I Should Have Honor, is about her childhood and how she became a women's rights activist. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Hi, this is Marco Werman calling from the World Program in Boston.
Oh, hello, my friend.
Are you ready to talk about pufferfish and making deadly foods non-deadly? Take a little pull on it and tell us what you're tasting.
If I breathe, you can actually hear me nosing it, right?
That's a nose. It's the first time, I've got to say, I've heard the trumpet used as a percussion instrument. Join us on The World this afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Executive power, abortion rights, campaign finance, they're all on the agenda this week as President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sits before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
If confirmed by the Senate, I will keep an open mind in every case.
A confirmation hearing that could reshape the court this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Our lives are hyper-connected. We've kind of built a world-sized robot. But what happens if it all goes wrong? Security guru Bruce Schneier says it's time for our laws to catch up with our tech. What are the hidden risks and the ones hiding in plain sight? Bruce Schneier on his new book, Click Here to Kill Everyone. Next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the Sing Out Loud Festival kicked off over the Labor Day weekend down in St. Augustine. And here's the good news. If you didn't come for the beginning, there are free concerts scheduled all this month, all around the town. Pretty exciting. Ryan Murphy is director of cultural events down in St. John's County. And Sing Out Loud Festival is on this year.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike last year, Ryan, when Hurricane Irma threw a little monkey wrench into everybody's plans.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. Last time we were talking about Sing Out Loud
last year.
I drove back to start making the call to start shutting stuff down, and we had to start evacuating. But we got back on our feet right after that, and we continued the festival. And I think it was a good spirit lifting event, and we helped raise money for United Way and to kind of help get people on their feet back there. But no bad weather this month.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah.
In a moment, we'll talk about the fundraising aspect of this year's festival. But first, who's performing?
We got a ton of artists. We got about, bless you.
Thank you. Sorry.
We've got about 240 local and regional artists, which is amazing. And then about like 30 headliners, including Jason Isbell, 400 Unit, Against Me, Rising Appalachia, Leftover Salmon, just this amazing, the Mountain Goats just played this weekend. It was a phenomenal show. And just a really diverse lineup. We're trying to hit every niche we can and kind of get everybody.
That's great.
Up.
And it goes through September 23rd. So lots of chances to see some live music. And yeah. I'm amazed you're going to make it through this month in one piece.
Well, it's amazing. We do this festival and then we still have shows. We got 3 shows of Widespread Panic and shows at the Concert Hall. And I mean, we're just business as usual.
Yeah. Now, where are all the venues for Sing Out Loud?
Most of them are located near St. Augustine, a lot of downtown St. Augustine venues. We utilize a lot of art galleries and venues and bars that have events, but then we do some shows at the Concert Hall and then at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall, as well as the amphitheater. And just, we try to stretch a little more and more each year until we're hopefully countywide, if not Northeast Florida wide. I'd love to get Jacksonville a little more involved. We bring down a lot of Jacksonville artists.
Sure.
So there is that collaboration, but yeah. Hopefully Northeast Florida by the time we're year 10, all of North Florida, maybe.
Now, this is free to the public, although you do ask for a donation of, say, $25. That's all going to go to the Betty Griffin House.
Correct. And that was just for one show specific. That's the main show on September 22nd at the amphitheater. And we did that as a mechanism to kind of control. We know if you just open up as free, a ton of people are going to show up. So we have to figure out a way to get tickets out there to ensure people could get a seat. And we always do it as a fundraiser. The first year is for the Pulse nightclub, the families of the Pulse nightclub victims. And that was through One Orlando. And this year,
Jason Isbell's camp and I worked on it, and we decided that the Betty Griffin Center in St. John's County, which does tremendous work, was going to be the beneficiary.
Yeah, they help victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, and you can go to BettyGriffinCenter.org for more about that. So this is an amazing gift to the First Coast, this festival. How do you get all these bands to perform for free, by the way?
Oh, the bands all get paid.
They do get paid.
Yeah, that's actually an important part of it, because I think a lot of these times you approach it and expect a lot of the artists to come for free or for exposure or something, but it's a huge part. We get a large TDC grant, and Community First Credit Union has been a great sponsor every year, and they've really helped us get behind this. But we pay every artist, we pay everyone working. So that actually feels really good. It's a good injection into the arts community.
How long have you been running all this amazing work in St. John's now? How long is it?
9 years.
9 years. Yeah. You have just revolutionized arts and culture in St. John's County, Ryan. You really have.
Thank you.
You bring in amazing performers to not only to the amphitheater, but to the Pontevedra Concert Hall, other venues. You've just really shaken things up in the most beautiful way. I hope people let you know that.
They do from time to time. I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's true. So if you've never seen the effect of Ryan's talents, you need to check out this month's Sing Out Loud Festival in St. John's County. It kicked off over Labor Day, but there are free concerts scheduled throughout most of September, all across the region. They just need to go to singoutloudfestival.com for the schedule, right?
Absolutely. And there's a really cool app that you can download that sets your whole schedule. It's a really, really cool thing.
Download the app. Mm-hmm. Check out the website. Take in some music. All but one concert is free, so you can't go wrong. Ryan Murphy, Director of Cultural Events in St. John's. Always good to see you. I'm glad the storm did not cancel your appearance this year. There's no wood in here to knock on. Yeah, dang it. We've got to hope for a nice, clean September after last year. My gosh. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
And have a great time. And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Our theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, can anyone fix a rigged economy? That discussion's coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and thanks for listening to 89.9. And if you missed any part of today's show, we have a new thing. It's our rebroadcast every night at 8 p.m. You can catch that tonight. And we'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.